You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriting. This is Mark Lintzenmeyer. For episode 9, I'm talking to Roderick Wolgamott Romero, the poet who founded and was the co-lead singer with his then-wife Anissa for Seattle space rock band Sky Cries Mary, which was active throughout the 90s and the mid-aughts. He now lives in New York, building elaborate treehouses for a living, having built ones for Sting, Julianne Moore, Val Kilmer, and many others. The music you're hearing right now is from Walla Walla, the opening track from Sky Cries Mary's breakthrough album, A Return to the Inner Experience, from 1993. The songs we're going to be discussing today are, first, a song, Gliding. The version we'll hear is from Taking the Stage Live, 1997 through 2005. Those performances were newly mixed for that 2011 release, which is their last album. We're also going to hear something from post-Sky Cries Mary, something brand new, from Roderick's in-progress spoken word album, One Point Moment Still. The song is called December Snow, and it's just a poem that Roderick recorded, actually only half of a poem, because the other half is in a different song. Then music was overlaid remotely by Romanian electronica duo Weed, that is W-E-apostrophe-D. And finally, we're going to talk about Queen of Slug Theater from Sky Cries Mary's Moon Bathing on Sleeping Leaves album from 1997. And we'll wrap up by listening to the song You Are from their last studio album, Small Town, 2007. Roderick is a tremendously open and friendly guy, and I hope you enjoy the interview. So here I am with Roderick Romero. Welcome.
Hey, thank you.
The first song we are going to hit in depth is this song Gliding. The version that you had picked was from the Taking the Stage live recording, but there was also the version from
Moon Bathing on Sleeping Leaves, wasn't it?
Yes, which is quite a different arrangement. That one is straight up acoustic, pretty much. No drums even, just bass and acoustic guitar and was it actual
accordion?
Actual accordion. Okay, not synth accordion. So this is several steps later in the band development. Do you have any sort of introductory words before we play it for the folks?
Sure. The idea was I was in Paris and I was thinking about Jean Genet, the great poet, because he got locked up in a prison because he kept stealing books. And I sat outside of the prison, Bastille, and that song just came to me in a blast. Sometimes I sketch things out and I piece together the lyrics, but that one just came to me in one straight line. I didn't even have to rework it. That's very rare. I didn't have, you know, look at different journals and stitch it together. It just hit me immediately. And the melody was also there. And so then I sang it to my guitarist, Michael Kotze, and I said, what do you think? And he's like, wow, okay. That's basically Gliding, you know, and Anissa was sitting next to me on the same bench. And she's just like, wow, you know, we got to record this one. And you know what's interesting about Gliding is the new album, One Point Moment Still, there's a through line. And the through line is this thief. Like the thief steals my pen.
Yeah.
The thief steals my wings. He just keeps stealing stuff from me. And so Gliding was the first hint at that idea. The new album is a pickup from that. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's the second song we're going to talk about is December Snow. So, well, let's play it for him.
Okay.
Forever. So there's some beautiful atmospherics on that. Was it just the composition of the band and what built up in your jams and the evolution of your live show that explains how this thick web of synth atmosphere developed beyond what was on the original version?
In the beginning, it was so stripped down. Well, this is one of my favorite songs that we've written. So then I was like, let's elaborate on it.
So that's a different recording on Taking the Stage than on the Here and Now 2005 live recording. Or is it the same recording remastered, reworked?
Different version. Here and Now was also produced by Chris Novoselic from Nirvana. He recorded that show and we played like three shows in a row.
I was kind of torn between using that and using the version that's on the compilation album Space Between the Drops, which is a 2006 re-recording. So it's after you did both these live things that you went back and added a little more. It's extra little computer noises. It's really most of what it is. It's an extra layer of texture.
Right, right. And we did that for Russia. That was like a Russian release, Trail Records, I think. I think. I really don't know anything about myself.
I want to get at fundamentally how you relate to the band, that you're the lyricist. I know you play some guitar. At least you did on the Sunshine Cake. I saw that was, you were credited with that. And you are credited in some stuff that I saw with rhythmic tracks or something. But for the most part, you just write and then organize and communicate. Is that right?
Yeah, basically, I'm the worst guitarist in the whole world. And so
that's
true. I'm always like chiming in. That's true. I'm a poet, and I write that way. And melodies come to me, and then I have to teach the melody to someone who can actually play guitar, like Michael Kotze or someone, or Mark Olson or someone like that. And then we go from there, and then really what happens is Ben Ireland comes in with his beat. And then that's where the song starts to happen. And then, like, say, Wano or Joe Bass comes in with the bass line. Then we add keyboards like Gordon Raphael, you know, who did the Strokes.
Yeah.
So it just kind of like expands from like a genesis of an idea, usually what I come up with. And then again, I can't actually even read music.
Even good guitarists can't read music. But does the idea of, oh, no, do a major seventh chord there, is that the kind of thing you think about? Or is it? It's not even names of chords. It's not.
No.
Okay.
It just comes naturally. And then I sing it. And then they translate it basically into an actual song.
So when you're bringing it to the group, because I'm always amazed when people have big bands and can manage them at all. Because I feel like when I'm working creatively in a studio setting, it's me and the lead guitarist kind of working through like, no, do that, do that. And it's a lot of me singing at the person, which I imagine is sounds like exactly what you're saying.
I write a lot of journals, a lot, like hundreds of journals. And so sometimes the guys will just be jamming and I'm like, oh, that sounds like that poem.
Oh.
And then I'll go grab that journal and then I'm like, oh yeah, this actually works. And sometimes it doesn't. Okay, let's grab another journal. And then I'm like, yes, that happens a lot.
All right. So it's a mix of some of your songs, the Skyscraper Mary stuff sound pretty obviously like it came from a jam, like there's a repetitive bass line that kind of just keeps going and you can see how this could have organically come up. But it sounds like Gliding in particular was not so much that. It was you singing a melody, like this is an actual song and then everybody else is filling it out.
Yeah. Another one that's like that is called The Headless Man, where it's just like a blast. Okay, I got the melody, blah, 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 and then I have to translate it again. Small Town was that way too. The song Small Town.
The melody in this, I hear a lot of, it sounds like a tango to me. I feel like Latin music is where, I know it's a place that I go often when you're trying to do something that's not straight head rock. You're trying to do something that's kind of exotic. That's one of those things. And it comes out as a tango or a cha-cha or something. We certainly don't even think in terms of those terms. Like it's not, no. This is a bossa nova, but like that's the flavor that it ends up having.
Blame it on the bossa nova. I don't consciously say, hey, let's do tango or a bossa nova. I don't know. It just comes out that way. You know, because here I am in Paris going to like cafes and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And then I'm sitting outside the prison and I'm thinking about Jean Genet. And then I'm like, it just kind of like happened. It was like only a thief would understand what to steal because of my like desire to possess beauty is basically, you know, like, the lyrics just kind of all came at the same moment. And all I had to do was just write it down.
Now, the melody that you came up with, was it the one that Anissa is singing, the sort of main melody, or was it the actual part that you were singing and she came up with something on top of that?
Well, she always does a harmony.
Mm-hmm. This one, it sounds like she's singing the main part and you're doing the harmony. It's at least in the main verse.
That happens a lot because Michael Kotze will be like, let's do it this way. Or like Paul Fox, who did Moonbathing on Sleeping Leaves, he'd be like, okay, let's give Anissa the feature. It doesn't really matter that I wrote the melody.
Right, right.
The Mamas and the Papas would do that kind of thing.
Sure. I guess the thing I'm always interested in is the trail between the initial inspiration and the finished product. Before you introduce it to the group of six people or whatever, is it that you and Michael have worked out an actual song structure between what you were singing and...
Well, sometimes.
In the case of this one, say.
Well, I think on this one, I think it's so close to Headless Man. I think it was like Juano and I sitting on my stoop outside my house, and I'd sing it to him and he'd start kind of riffing on it. And then he and I wrote it, but we always share all publishing.
Mm-hmm.
So even if someone didn't contribute anything as far as songwriting, everyone shared the publishing. That was really important to the band. And so I think on Gliding, it was Juano and I, basically. You know he's the lead singer for Yes. Now,
yes,
right?
I do. I do. That's crazy.
That's just...
yeah, we should move a little bit on to the second one. So let's just do a transition to, we've got kind of a picture of the way that you worked for quite a long time. I know you started Sky Cries Mary with a different setup, that it was you and the two guys from the Posies, but it was still kind of the same. You were coming in with poems and melodies and working with instrumentalists to build this thing around it. This is one, it's called December Snow. So this is the first recording of it, right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so it's called a remix, but that's just because it's Sean Coryell who curates these things and likes the word remix, but it's really the first time in what you went to his place and recorded this new poem, and then he sent it out to Weed, W-E-apostrophe-D, that did the background music.
Right.
Which is Christina and Dan Handrabur from Bucharest.
I was in Hawaii building a treehouse, and then I said, hey, Sean, I've got these new poems. And I was kind of like, not like I was... channeling or something. I was just thinking about, like, if Morrison kept writing, you know, if he didn't die, what would he have written? And so I wrote these poems and I read them to Sean, and he's like, wow, because there's like Right on the Moon kind of started, and then December Snow, it was about this girl I was seeing at the time. And then Sean's like, hey, how about these guys do a version? And I was like, sounds good, you know, because they were with Network, which is one of my favorite labels. Like Skinny Puppy was on Network. So was Sarah McLaughlin. They were very diverse label. I loved them. And so then Sean says, how about they do a version? And I was like, yeah, okay, cool. So that's their interpretation of my lyrics.
So I'm sure it's partly their familiarity with your work or just choosing carefully a group to do. It's funny that there's accordion featured here in the massive synth stuff when that was the thing in Gliding that was the key instrumental feature in the original version. I'm sure it's just coincidence.
I didn't even think of that.
And also that it's kind of the main feature of the instrumental after you stop with your poem and it goes into this kind of Pink Floyd-y jam for another 3 minutes is this swooping female, vaguely Indian Arabic sounding lead vocal, much like what Anissa would do in the Sky Cries Mary.
It kind of scared her. Like, Anissa was not happy about that because it does sound a lot like her. And it was not like a copy.
Sure.
It's just like how she sings. She's Romanian. That's her style. Anissa has a very particular voice, but it wasn't a copy. It just is how it was.
Now, for some of the tunes, like the fourth one we're going to see, You Are, that I know you ended up doing kind of the chorus and Anissa sang the verse. Did Anissa come up with the melody on that? I'm still trying to get a sense of like, or did that still was written sort of the normal way where you came up with the melody and the lyrics and...
Yeah, I came up with all of that. It's like a love song. You know, I was trying to save my marriage, which failed, of course. It was like a love song. You were all I wanted, all I needed to believe in. That's me saying, you're everything to me, you know.
All right. Folks will have to wait till the end to hear that. Right now, we still haven't played yet. December Snow. Let's go ahead and play it.
The thief's back. He tries to steal my pen. As it strikes the paper, I race to record another moment. Turn left at the black hole. Find love in a drop of dew. In the grapevine's ripened fruit. Drink in the silence. Inhale the gift from our natural world. Let go of the invisible. Know that it is there. Everywhere, everything is energy. Flowing from one form to another. I'm so grateful to rediscover the warm fire within my core. As I'm blessed with your eyes and blooming lips, I would sacrifice 5 more lifetimes to dance with you now. To walk arm in arm in the December snow. In the December snow.
All right. So we haven't really gone sort of line by line for either song yet. So let's, I know we brought up December Snow, that we picked this in particular because this is typical of a thing that you do. Obviously you write poetry and sometimes it could come out as an actual song. And the thing that really interested me again with gliding is when you're sort of just singing from the heart, where these initial melodies come from, because it's quite different than if somebody comes to you with a chord progression or, you know, a song that's basically already written instrumentally and you're trying to come up with something interesting to do that's playing off that. That's kind of where I was seeing more the way that Anissa comes up with melodies is that, I mean, you had described it as you two singing together is you're like the bass and she's like the guitar that can, you know, go in solo and fly around. And
as much as I love Anissa, she just does harmonies. I always come up with the melody.
I guess what I'm referring to as her melodies is her improvisational, pretty obviously. I don't think you, okay, Anissa, now go, like do that, that kind of.
No, that's totally true.
Which is exactly what the person for December Snow was doing, with that you were saying was a similar style. Cause that's when you're a vocalist and you've got this background and you kind of want to add your thing. I mean, you become like a jazz musician when you have that kind of quality voice. And of course it's going to sound, there's going to be a certain similarity in the way different people do their spinny, the equivalent of a lead guitar solo version of a voice.
It's a very, very good point, is that I would never write her part. She always came up with her part. Like, I'm not going to like go, okay, yeah, like you said, woo, woo. You know, she comes up with that. And then usually like someone like Ian, who produced the first two albums, and then Paul Fox, and then Michael Kazi, they would say, oh, this is great. Let's double it. Let's triple it, because it's such a hook. She always came up with the hooks, to be honest. I was never like a big hook writer. You know, like the hook, you know, is like the clincher on a song to make it popular.
I guess the hook in December Snow is, in the December snow, the December, and that kind of echoes throughout the rest of the song. That's very hooky. It's very.
That's funny. You know, I live in New York, and I was walking down the street with this girl, and I just was like arm in arm, you know, December snow. It just was like this kind of perfect moment. And it linked into Right on the Moon. I wrote all of it together, but it got cut in a cool way. So it's actually one extended poem. But there is this like differential, you know, so there is this moment where it's like, okay, this is kind of a new poetic movement, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So let's talk about The Thief. You had in Gliding, please won't you help me through my prison? Someone has stolen my wings. To steal from a thief is nothing from nothing. Well, first, what is this stealing from a thief?
You know, only a thief would understand my desire to possess beauty, because it's like thief knows what to steal. And so I'm looking at the prison. And I'm like, everyone in there is pretty much a thief.
The thing that I'm confused about here, so he was a thief, the book thief, and being a book thief is, of course, especially somebody wrote a whole book about the book thief. And
yeah.
Is this the same one that the popular book is about? I don't know anything about the popular book that I don't think is actually called The Book Thief, but I know I've seen people reading it.
Yeah, it's just the idea.
Uh-huh.
That, like, sometimes the thief is the person who steals your pen when you get, like, writer's block or something, okay? You just can't write. And then suddenly the pen comes back and it strikes the page and it becomes the poem. Sometimes it's like, who's this guy who stole my pen? You know? And so then suddenly it's like, oh, I got my pen back, and it strikes the page. And then next thing you know, you got a poem. The thief is like a reoccurring theme, which also maybe it's a reference to, say, Bob Dylan, because he talks about the thief a lot. I'm not saying I, you know, stole the idea. It's a theme. And the theme of that is what I'm trying to write as a book, which is an audio album. So, like, what Sean and I have been talking about is that we do chapters. So, Right on the Moon is a chapter. December Snow is a chapter. And then Prayers and Curses is a chapter. So, I'm writing this through line. So, it's continuous.
And remind me what the name of this eventual project is going to be.
1 point moment still.
Okay.
And it's a very meditative title. So it's like 1 point. Finally, I'm like trying to get calm, because I'm bipolar. You know, I have a lot of trouble just getting my mind together. And so 1 point moment still is the idea that I just can sit and be all right, not manic, just calm. Which never really happens. But it's where I want to go. It's what I want, is to be calm and meditative.
And I can see how writer's block could be a function of not being able to achieve that. Actually, contemplating the lyrics of Bob Dylan is a good way to get writer's block, because, oh, he already did something like that. Obviously, you're channeling your influences, but you don't want them to overwhelm what you're doing. Or you're talking about other poets that inspired you. The particular model of other poets ever kind of get in the way, or how do you exactly relate to your ancestors in that way?
Well, not really. This was like Lou Reed and I started hanging out. I was just writing, and I would throw stuff at him, and he'd be like, yeah, Roderick, you're on it. like Prayers and Curses. He's like, Roderick, I think you found your voice finally. You know, because he's listened to the entire pantheon of Sky Cries. And he's like, you got it. This is what you need to do. You know, and I was like, oh my gosh, thank you. You know, he loves small town. We would go over to his house because I have a really crap stereo system, but I only listen to vinyl. And he's like, have you actually listened to Small Town on a real stereo system? I was like, no. So we went over and I was like almost crying. I was like, oh, wow. You know, we had breakfast every Monday if we were in the same city. He was a mentor.
Yeah.
He changed my life completely. And so did Laurie Anderson because they are together. And Laurie and I are very, very close. And so we also now have breakfast together. Just, it's like a tradition in a way. You know, he's such a special person, you know. Like, the example is, okay, so maybe the Velvet Underground only sold like 30,000 records, but all of those 30,000 people started a band. You know what I mean? All right. You know, I think Eno said that. I can't remember, or Philip Glass. And that's the idea. Okay, 30,000 people only bought Velvet Underground records, but all 30,000 people started a band. There wouldn't be like any of these bands without the Velvet Underground.
It must have something to do with sort of the complexity and the relationship to technique versus just putting out your gut that makes the difference between, I mean, you don't hear, oh, Stravinsky. Not that many people heard Stravinsky, but every single person that heard him went and wrote their own symphony. Like, you don't hear that about that kind of thing.
Exactly. And Stravinsky was bipolar. True story.
Because I was watching that Mozart in the Jungle.
Right.
And one of the characters played by Malcolm McDowell has been a conductor. So he knows really well the different pieces of classical music and then goes to finally compose his own thing and finds that every single little thing he does, even though he's very good in the arrangements, but every single thing ends up being some kind of near exact quote from something, you know, because he's just been so immersed in all this great music.
Exactly.
But you don't hear that, or, you know, you might say, okay, all those people that went and formed bands after hearing the Velvet Underground, well, a lot of what they did was very much quotations from the, but in rock, it just doesn't matter. That's kind of not the point. Since rock is more of a folk art form, you don't accuse a folk singers of, oh, you're singing Oh Susanna too much like the Pat. I mean, that's kind of the point.
Well, yeah, because a lot of what I do is I walk around a lot. And sometimes you're walking down the street and someone just says something so esoteric. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. You know, and you know, it's like when Warhol said to Luz, like, I hit you with a flower. Right. You know, Warhol said that to him and he's like, oh, that's a fucking good lyric. You know, I'm like, okay. You know, and sometimes I'll just be walking down the street and I'll hear stuff like that. And then I'll just write it down. Sometimes I forget it. But if I have my journal, I sit down and I write it. So I'm actually stealing, the thief, little snippets from things that I hear when I'm walking down the street.
I'm still seeing an ongoing theme in your work. I mean, in Gliding here, is it The Rain is on Fire? So these elemental, there's a lot of fire and water and rivers and rain and stuff like that throughout your songs. That these are kind of these.
Well, I grew up in Seattle, right? So rain's pretty.
Yes.
It's not the theme anymore. It's like Sacramento.
Now it's snow. Maybe I'm trying to make a distinction between these sort of fundamental archetypal things coming out of the soul and the everyday world. But it seems like maybe there's no different as far as you're concerned. That the reason these things are, well, you don't see rain on fire walking around unless you have very bad acid rain. Hopefully.
That's a pretty good reference.
Turn left at the black hole. Where?
Yeah, there's a good one.
Hopefully that's not something you're just running into, but
it's just like something that kind of flashes into your head. And I'm like, oh yeah, turn left in the black hole or the rain is on fire. It's like, I don't know where it comes from. Obviously I don't see rain on fire.
Yeah. What does that metaphor really mean to you? Or does that make sense to ask that question?
Well, what's the line before it and after it?
Well, to steal from a thief is nothing from nothing. Nothing like smoke is all I see.
Right.
Fire, the rain is on fire. My head is in flames. My lungs are like trees, for I'm locked inside this burning forest. I hope they take care of my wings. So the last line is obviously just going back to the wing thing from the beginning.
Right. The thief steals my wings. I'm stuck in a prison. I'm Jean Genet. Holy hell, I can't get out of here. And the rain is on fire. It's just, you know, he's trapped. He's just stuck. Stuck in this burning forest, and the rain's on fire because the forest is burning. So the rain is on fire. The rain's coming down, but the forest is burning. And it's like smoke is all I see. He's trying to get out of this prison. It's just like a bad situation. They're not going to let him out until, like, Cocteau shows up, and he's like, you got to get this guy out of here. He's a genius. So Cocteau shows up, which is true. It's not in the song, but Cocteau's the one who got Jean Genet out of prison.
Founder of the Cocteau twins. No, I was...
I love them.
Well, no, I mean, I like this whole thing, you know, just like the thief stealing my pen, that these are just metaphors for psychological stuff, which, of course...
Right.
What you do, you don't just talk about the stones of the prison, although you could talk about that. You could be very literal, but, and the way that you mix those up in December Snow as well, that it's talking about nature very directly, drink in the silence, inhale the gift of our natural world, but then also turn left at the black holes right in there as well, that it's.
I don't. Well, with Right on the Moon in December Snow, I was thinking like, climb up into the family tree. You got to get off the street. You're climbing up, and then you're hiding away, and then you're embraced by, you know, lover's arms. It's just like, it's just a sweet, you know, they're all metaphors, basically.
Although we have to be clear that, I think I will have said this at the beginning, but that your day gig is designing tree houses now, so climbing the family tree is quite literal.
Definitely. But, you know, but I've been researching my family tree also. You know, so I went to Norway in September to try to find my great grandmother's house. And then I went to Scotland like 4 weeks ago to try to find my roots there. Cause I'm like one half Scottish, one quarter Russian, and then one quarter Norwegian. Americans a lot don't even get into it unless you're Mormon or something. You know, you just don't get into your genetics. It's very important to me to know where I came from.
One other theme with these two songs that I was wondering about is, you guys are known as space rock, or as the descendants of space rock.
Right, which I love.
And there's a lot of synthesizers, obviously, in Gliding and in the later stuff. And even guitars, they're so affected that they might as well be synthesizers. Like, they have more...
That's a good point.
More expressive power. But even the synthesizers, those sounds are chosen to have expressive power. You were saying that Peter Gabriel is one of your idols, and the way he has used synthesizers forever is just so inspiring. I mean, the Passion soundtrack is like one of my favorite things. So he's able to mix, well, actually listening back to it now, that was from 1989, there is something a little dated about it in that the exact synth sound that you would pick to go over the Ney flute or whatever the acoustic instrument is probably not what you would pick now. You know, but that's always been the sort of the goal, I think, of at least a certain strain in synthesizer use, is to really make them sound like a big string orchestra or like your soul moving, to make them really expressive and not synthy at all, not spacey.
The thing is that Gordon Raphael is a genius. The way Gordon would play was just insane and beautiful and somewhat random. He made our sound in that sense, in space rock sense, because no one was playing like that. You know, maybe Gentle Giant or Eno. His discordal parts, he would do sevenths, he would do all these crazy stuff. And half the band was actually into prog rock, and I don't like prog rock, to be honest.
It seems like more structured than you would be so excited about.
Well, the cool thing is that you got half the band just going one way, and you got another half the band going another way, and then you put it all together, and it's just like, whoa, what a crazy sound.
Yeah, no, and that certainly seems like a good solution. I mean, I've certainly been in enough situations where, with musicians, that they just want to, I just want to get very zen and jam, and often what that turned into was something that was just very repetitive, and I didn't feel like it was that interesting. But if you've got guys with that have a prog background or a jazz background, those kind of guys going in and doing that stuff, well, that's how you get like Miles Davis Bitches Brew. I mean, that's
exactly
which actually really does seem mood wise a distant parent of Sky Cries Mary.
My other Miles record that I love is Sketches of Spade, because it's just like I love Sketches of Spade. The entire album is one movement, but with different bridges and things.
Yes.
You know?
Although it's interesting how different the making of those two albums is, because Sketches of Spain is so much a one guy, was it Gil Evans, who arranged the strings on that?
Gil Evans.
Right. Yeah. So that if you're arranging strings, obviously it's not improvisational. It's a very focused, controlled thing. Whereas the Bitches Brew, I mean, I've heard the album, then I've heard like the sessions that it was taken from album. That's what's like a 4-disc or 5-disc long thing of just all these jams that were then. It sounded like that was kind of part of the way that Sky Christ Mary songs would get put together, is that you'd have these jams and just pick out parts that you liked and kind of glom them together and make them into a song.
That's pretty much right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, but we would write different ways. That was the cool thing. Maybe that's the downfall of the band, to be honest, is that there was no continuous, like, Radiohead or Coldplay or something. They have this thing, and they stick with it. Whereas Sky Christ, I even would go into, like, what you almost could call rap. You know, my poetry, like, set to beats. And then you got something like Gliding, totally different arrangements, totally different music. So no one could really latch on to, like, oh, unless they just were a fan of Sky Christ. You know?
Well, yeah, it just seemed an overall mood. And then I guess you kind of used Anissa as your visual center, and you know that she's on the cover of some of the albums. And I mean, I've seen videos of your stage show, which is, it's interesting. It's not necessarily what I would have pictured. And it just, it seems a very unique setup for a band that there are two singers. You got the Jim Morrison thing, but it's two people.
If X became a space rock band, right? You get these like, you know, or the Mamas and the Papas or Jefferson Airplane. It's just like the sound. And Anissa was my muse. She inspired like almost everything I ever wrote.
Let's channel specifically into our third song, because we need to get around to that. Queen of Slug Theater. Talk about how that was inspired.
We used to live in this house called the Purple House. In the back, I had this bizarre little Chinese queen character, a doll. And then I would set her back there. And then every morning I'd come out and the slugs had messed her up. Like
actual slugs. So this is not a metaphor. This is...
No. It's the real deal. And so then sometimes when we would throw parties, I would set all these candles up and we would call it, you know, the Queen of Slug Theater. And she'd be covered in like slime.
Big from parties. I went to that party.
Huge parties. Yeah. And everybody's just like, Roderick, you're out of your mind. And so I wrote a song about it because I thought it was just so funny. Here's this little Chinese doll getting covered in slug goo, and every day it changed. And so it became this little theater piece, and I made a little set around it. So it was in a box, kind of like a set. And then I kept elaborating around it and then creating lighting, you know. And then I'm like, hey, it's time for Queen of Slug Theater. And that's it.
Thank you.
You're going to have to help me with the lyrics on this. I did my best just listening to it closely to figure out what you were trying to say, but just trying to connect that with the story you were just telling. Is it into goodbye today, in love gone to play, something? What are the first lines?
No, okay. That's right.
Something where the rivers flow, not so sweet as snow. Is it don't lose where the rivers flow, something like that?
I have no idea.
Okay. Is this not one that you played live that much?
Not a lot, because it's just so esoteric, and it's a long song, and most of the band
it's
just
about 5 minutes. It's not Elephant Song. That's like 8 minutes, nine.
Yeah, but that's a good song. Yeah. Queen of Slug Theater's just like, who writes a song like that? It's just like, it was just crazy. But everyone got it in the band because they saw Slug Theater. But the rest of the world is like, what is he up to, you know?
I don't even think that for a lot of what you do, even though these songs often start with you coming up with lyrics and a melody, it's very hard often to focus on lyrics at all, I feel. I'll start playing one of your songs and I'll just kind of get carried away and realize, like, I don't know and I don't care what's being said. Like, that it's almost more the charm and then you guys as singers again, the dancing around in this ecstatic union among a bunch of really cool light show. Like, seems like this is very much in the spirit of how it was intended. So to drill back into it, like, I think you could be as obscure as you want with the words, and as long as they sound cool, then it's perfectly effective. So the fact that people might not understand literally what this means, I don't think it makes it a less effective song at all. I know I had kind of gotten you to suggest this just because for the third slot here, we try to do something that's, I don't know, a little atypical, something that maybe didn't quite work.
And I was like, oh yeah, Queen of Slug Theater.
This is actually one of my favorite songs on this album. And I like stuff like Oingo Boingo and these kind of dark. I was playing this for my daughter who's 12 and she's like, this is a really funny Halloween song is the way she described it. That you've got actual like horror movie screaming at the end of it. Where would that come from? Is that something that Paul Fox would say? We need some added screaming here.
No, that's Anissa.
Okay.
You know, she would go into these like operatic horror story kind of vocals, you know, but it was like angst and thematic. Let's just blow this thing out. You know, and we would just multi-track her. Like, okay, Anissa, just keep going. What are you going to come up with next? It's just like, oh my Lord, you know?
Well, and when she's already singing, right, basically the main melody, or when you say this started with the words, it started with the melody, the Into Goodbye Today part, but there's a whole giant intro before that. Is that something that would just kind of work out in the arrangement that you'd say, all right, here's the kind of melody that I want for the actual song, but then there's a good, 30 seconds at least before that of these drums and Anissa and the guitar chiming together on this melody?
Yeah. Well, it's a lot like Walla Walla into Moving Like Water, mm-hmm. Right? It's like this tribal beats, and then suddenly it's like you pop into a song. They go right into each other. So Walla Walla means many waters. Mm-hmm. And then so Moving Like Water was just the progression. We would do that with like Stretched. We do that a lot. You know, we'll connect songs. We have to separate them in a way, but they move right into the next one, you know, and I love that.
And you were, I guess, mentioning on another interview I heard that this, so the last song we're going to play is from the Small Town album. It's called You Are. Again, I was playing this to my daughter and this is the only one that she added to her on the go playlist. So it passed. It's right next there to Taylor Swift and other.
That's hilarious. I have a 10-year-old daughter and she loves that song too.
Yeah. That whole album, it sounds a little more like, I know you didn't play the guitars on it, but it sounds as if you could have just written these, you know, there's a lot of acoustic strumming parts, but it's between you and Michael Kotze mostly, I guess.
Mono.
Okay. But coming up with kind of more straight ahead songs.
All I need is it's a huge fucking hook.
Yeah. As opposed to Queen of Slug Theater and these other things from that era that are more, you know, you've got a core of a song and it's really the jam of the band that gets it going. It sounds like with this last album that you were more, you know, at least mailing tapes, sending MP3s or whatever back and forth.
That's true.
I guess that's the way The Cure does it too, as well. I remember hearing that, you know, they all contribute, but it's a matter of, at least in the later albums, sending these melodic bits around to each other.
Right. Or Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
There's a good example. They hate each other.
They don't co-write. There's no shared publishing on that. That's a freaking Lindsey Buckingham song and that's a Stevie Nicks song. That seems a whole different, political. It seems you've presented an admirable model of how to manage a large band and keep them happy. I was just watching this. I know you kind of lost and gained members over the years as they went to do other things, but I was watching that video that's on YouTube that I'll link folks to of what it's just October 2015, where you had this big reunion show that was most of the old members and new members. And they're all just talking about what a wonderful family it is and just how that it just seems like you not just sharing the publishing, but having a writing style that wasn't just, these are my songs and I'm going to tell you what to do with them. That it was.
No, it's never been that way. It's never been that way. So it's like we present different things. And then if everyone likes it, then we're like, cool. You know, it's not like this has to be like this. And that reunion show, you know, it was for Joe because, you know, he has prostate cancer. And Joe's such a brother to me. And it was so neat because it got us back together. And it was like every player since 1990, you know, minus like Ken and John from the Posies. Everybody showed up because we all loved Joe. And we wanted to raise money for him. And he's a sweetheart, that guy, Joe. I always think of myself the same with the Treehouses. Is like a conductor. So yeah, I'm like, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this. And when I'm on stage, it's the same thing because everyone knows my hand signals. So it's like, bam, okay, say when the fear stops or something. It's like they're waiting for my hand signal to go bam. Nick Cave would do that. Same kind of thing. It's like a conductor. I don't know if that's too precocious, but I don't know.
Is part of that also, again, kind of singing little melodies at people of just like you had come up with the melody for the of, you know, I kind of hear a guitar line that's something like, and then you'd sing, like, is that the kind of interaction that you'd have with people? Or would it be more just like, you play guitar, you come up with the guitar line, I'm just going to say cool or not cool or.
Well, yeah, like say Small Town, you know, obviously I live in New York. And so I would think of something and then I would call Michael and leave it as a message. Like most of those songs, I would just call him and he would keep them. And then he's like, oh, I get it. And then, you know, he'd figure out actually the chordal progression because I can't write quarterly. And so he's like, is that right? And I'm like, perfect. And then he'd bring in Ben and Wano and blah, blah, blah. And then they'd build the song. And then I'd be like, that's it. And then I would kind of like stitch some of the lyrics back together. And I'm like, okay, here's the chorus. Here's the verses. And then we all got together in Seattle and it made sense.
But still having the approach of we're sharing the publishing, we're sharing the co-writing, like that's just a given. So you can kind of be as free as you want to. It doesn't really matter who comes up with what exactly or who's saying what. You don't have to think so hard. I mean, I think of like a band like The Church, which is three writers, and they'll even though it'll be listed all three of their names in the byline for a particular song, they'll change the order of who is listed first, like based on kind of who came up with the most stuff in it. Or,
I love The Church. I can't even. I believe you're referencing them. I love The Church.
I hear similarity. It's definitely the open spacey kind of sound that you guys both like.
They wrote such beautiful stuff. Or Psychedelic Furs, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or I was just interviewing Gary Lucas a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about Captain Beefheart doing the same thing that you're talking about, that he would call him up and like sing him a melody of a thing. And then somehow Gary would come up with a guitar solo based on that.
Right.
And I believe that the end credits would end up being, oh, this is Gary Lucas's solo guitar. There's no other instruments playing interpretation of a Captain Beefheart song. So Captain Beefheart, in fact, gets the writing credit for going in it.
Exactly.
So I like your way better. If that's, I don't mean to slander Captain Beefheart, but.
I love them. I mean, are you kidding me? Like Para Ubu or David Byrne. These are huge influences for me. David Bowie was probably my biggest influence besides Lou and John Lennon and Bob Marley and Dylan. And then like David Byrne says, we're the band of the year for Spin Magazine, you know, back in the day. I was like, really? Oh my God. Because he's an idol. To me, he's like a huge inspiration. I was like, we're the band of the year. You freaking kidding me? You know?
So, that's where your tango came from.
Right.
Although it's funny that, you know, when David Byrne does that or did that, at least he decided to make it explicit at some point and actually labeled on his, these two tracks are bossa novas. This is, thank God.
Yeah. Blame it on the bus. And I'm going to say that again. Anissa was really inspired by Brazilian music because she lived in Brazil. Mm. for a year and a half when she was in 10th grade, 11th grade. And so she got into like Chico Buarque and that. She got into like this whole Brazilian thing. And so she brought also that to Sky Cries, you know, where I had no reference to it. Also, she brought like the India, the country.
Yes.
She would bring that into it. And then you got prog rock from Gordon and, you know, and then you got Ben, who's a jazz drummer. And it's just like this crazy collage of musicians. And I think that's why Sky Cries is, in a sense, very, very unique.
Yeah, yeah. Well, once you kind of establish a psychedelic anything goes sort of setup, then anything can go. So that's
exactly. There's no parameter. It's just like, okay. Yeah. And improvisation is huge. I went to a grad school in Paris, and the entire school was improvisation.
This was a theater program, right?
Yeah, right. And so the whole thing was just like, you make your class. Like, what do you want it to? And it was just like surreal because they only take two students from 16 countries to make the class. So you've got, there's two people and there's two from each country. None of us knew each other, but at the same time, it created this beautiful thing. And I really brought that to Sky Cries because it's like improvisation. It's like, okay, guys, let's just jam for a while and then I'll find a poem. And I'm like, that fits that. Unless it was like something that blasted me all the way through. And I'm like, hey guys, you know, but mostly it was jams. And I would just grab different journals. Like, okay, that sounds like that. You know, because I think the music needs to tell the story just as well as the lyrics. So if you took all the lyrics out, you should have the same kind of feeling, you know, as if you knew the words. And that's key to me.
Well, thanks so much for doing this. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you, too.
All right, here again is You Are, which was not a jam. Well, thanks, folks, for listening to another episode. I really enjoyed talking to Roderick. He is so genuine. He is so friendly. I did find it challenging in terms of my stated purpose of the podcast to talk through and analyze the songs. You know, despite the fact that I write a lot of lyrics myself, I do not consider myself a poet. My lyrics are not meant to be freestanding. In fact, I have a hard time focusing on poetry. Never really took a course in poetry. Haven't had that many positive experiences, frankly, taking in poetry. So someone who identifies himself as a poet is a little bit foreign to me. And I know there are lots of kinds of poets, but I got the feeling, talking to Roderick, given the volume of poetry he writes, the many notebooks full of things, it doesn't seem like he second-guesses himself much. And maybe he was just being cagey, but I definitely did not succeed here in getting him to analyze his own poetry after the fact. He could describe the circumstances where he wrote the poem, and he could more or less repeat lines, say, hey, look how I use the motif of the thief, or you can see how these lyrics are about the guy in the Bastille. But I couldn't get him to elaborate, really, on the themes in the songs beyond what he actually put in there, or on his various literary techniques or any of that. So either I just didn't push hard enough, didn't ask the right questions, or that's just not the way he thinks of his work. That he has an explosion of inspiration, and then that's it. I know he talked about piecing things together from different journals, but I don't know to what extent words would actually get revised during that process. Anyway, hopefully these poet types are not too rare. We'll get another one on the show sometime and ask more about that process. You can see I quickly shifted tack to talking about what I really found interesting about being a poet in a band, which is how do you get a band if you're a poet? Poets are not the most high profile of individuals. People do not flock to a poet and say, please let me play some music behind what you have. So it was Roderick's industriousness, his charisma, his organizational skills that brought these various musicians into his circle to do his bidding in a very friendly, collaborative, supportive environment, of course, with shared publishing, shared royalties, and then to marry somebody who ends up being really the other half of your single vocal. I know Roderick was saying, oh yeah, the Mamas and the Papas and Jefferson Airplane, there are plenty of groups that have a male and a female lead singer, but not with this kind of interaction where they almost always sing together, where they're a unit, not like a choir, but like an ecstatic single front man, front person, front entity. So you get the advantage of Jim Morrison at the front in terms of the charismatic poet. But even if you are not the most dynamic singer yourself, if you could layer somebody on top of you that sounds like Susie Sue and be co-lead singers, man, that is a formula that would be very difficult to replicate. Maybe you could put that on your eHarmony profile or something. Anyway, thanks to Roderick. And like many of our past episodes, I did keep talking to Roderick for a while after this. There were topics that are not included in the recording you just heard, and I've packaged those together as bonus audio and put them behind the paywall. So if you become a $5 a month Nakedly Examined Music / Partially Examined Life supporter, a PEL citizenship is what we call it on the site at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, which is just a subsection of partiallyexaminedlife.com, that being the parent podcast of this one. And the good thing about that relationship is we've got this huge infrastructure set up so that if you go sign up for this recurring donation, you get access not only to Nakedly Examined Music bonus audio, but several years of bonus audio from my other podcast and all of my recent albums, both as Mark Lint and as New People. So you might want to consider doing that, or at the very least, make sure you are subscribed to Nakedly Examined Music and go leave a nice review of the podcast on the iTunes store. Thank you for your support. This is Mark Lintonmeyer saying to you all, happy musicking. Bye-bye.